Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Ah. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Oh, hi, I didn't see you there. We're going to jump into the show here in just a second, but first I want to talk to you about our Patreon page at BobSuskaShow.com. You might have noticed that most other podcasts only present one show per week or even one show per month, but here on this show, the Bob Suska Show, we record 4 shows every week. In fact, make it 6 shows a week if you include the postmortem bonus shows on our Patreon page. And since we're not part of a cable news network or a fancy corporation, we rely on your support to keep producing upwards of 6 shows per week. And the best way to support the Bob Suska Show is, of course, to sign up for as little as $1 per month at BobSuskaShow.com. That's pennies per show and only $12 per year. But it goes a long way toward allowing us to keep up with the fire hose of news every day. Again, that's BobSuskaShow.com or just click the all caps Patreon link beneath the logo at BobSuska.com. And now let the cartoons begin.
Recorded live in the USA, covering the whole wide world.
Right on!
This is the Bob Suska Show, presented by BubbleGenius.com.
From our nation's capital, it is Wednesday, July 14, 2021, and this is the interview edition of the Bob Suska Show on the Sexy Liberal Podcast Network. Hi, my name is Bob.
Hello, Bob.
Hello. Day 176 of the Biden-Harris administration, 482 days until the 22 midterms. Find me on Instagram at TheBobSuska and on Twitter at BobSuska_go. All right, John Amato, the founder of CrooksAndLiars.com, is here today. Years ago, I don't know if you know this, but years ago, John invited me to contribute to his blog and, along with the Huffington Post, helped me to get my name and my voice out there, and I might not be doing what I'm doing right now had it not been for those platforms. Well, today, we're going to talk about the origins of Crooks and Liars, maybe some reminiscing about the old days of Blogosphere 1.0 in there, too. I definitely want to ask John about his incredible music career as well. The man played saxophone with Duran Duran, Ringo Starr, The Knack, Ronnie Montrose, and so many more. This is going to be a blast for those of you who've been with the blog since the middle 2000s, so get ready. In the meantime, if you like what you hear today, don't forget to subscribe to our bonus content at patreon.com/BobSuskaShow. Okay, let's catch up with the great John Amato from Crooks and Liars. So how you been?
It's crazy as usual. Every day is a new fucking adventure.
Yeah, no kidding. How did you manage through the pandemic?
Well, you know, being an OG blogger,
yeah.
You know, I'm used to sort of, you know, working, you know, where I live and all that. And I moved to a little more isolated spot. But, you know, I had a lot of family members get infected. It's funny, when it first started, I have, like I said, I have my niece's husband. He got it, and he's an electrician. And then he got it early on, and you know, he couldn't get a test for like 4 or 5 days. And then it, you know, he went through the whole protocols, and he wound up getting it like a month later. So it did spread through my family. I know there were neighbors, older neighbors that got it in my area that passed away. And what my family tells me is, you know, when they even say like, oh, it only affects, you know, old people, you know, one of my closest relatives said he knew seven people that had passed away from COVID between 35 and 50.
Good God. Wow.
So, you know, I did the best I could. And, you know, Sammy, my cat for 16 years, passed away on March 30th.
Oh.
And it was tough, yeah, because, you know, you can tell, like, I knew, you know, he'd been a little sick for a while. Mm. And then to try to even get him to the vet at that time was hard.
Yeah. Yeah. I can imagine.
And but, you know, I made it through the election. 6 months, a year was insane.
Yeah. Right. Right.
With the craziness. I mean, I've been covering right-wing media, or all media actually, since 2004.
Oh yes.
And, you know, I was one of the first, obviously, I was the first to start putting video up of these crazy cretins of hell that just serially lie and are trying to get their viewers killed now.
Yeah.
But I just remember even back in the old days, there was this, I think his name was it John Gibson that was on Fox?
Yeah.
That they were back around 2005 or so, Fox was angry because whites weren't populating the country enough.
I remember that. Yeah, yeah.
Right? And right. It's like, we got to give people five in the noggin and... Right. That's what I had called them. And then it's, you know, you have to start making more babies, because if not, I mean, they were doing this right around 2004, 5, 6. If you don't make enough babies, then the brown people are going to take over. I mean, that was the first. It's just gotten exponentially worse, especially when you get a narcissistic buffoon.
Right. Right.
Con man running that party. It just open the floodgates of complete insanity.
Oh, yeah, yeah. In fact, you know what? You were mentioning that Crooks and Liars was the first blog to do video, which it very much was. I mean, you guys were at the forefront of that. But it was one of the first group blogs as well, which is now, I think most blogs are group blogs now. But you guys were at the forefront of that. It wasn't just you. You had a whole troop of other bloggers working with you at Crooks and Liars at the same time. And that was, you know, you rewind back to around the time that we met in the midst of Blogosphere 1.0, 2004, 2005, 2006. That was a big deal. You guys were breaking some ground there.
Yeah, it was pretty wild. I mean, you know, any adventure that you partake in, especially with the Blogosphere back then, you know, I didn't start this with the idea of, oh, wow, I'm going to, you know, do something different or spectacular. Mm-hmm. I'm a creative person, you know, I'm a musician, but I've always been also, you know, back in grade school, I wanted to be Rod Serling. You know, I loved the Twilight Zone twist ending stories, and I had wanted to be a writer. And when I first went to college, I wanted to be a journalist because I wanted to be a writer, and then I won a music scholarship, but that's a whole other
situation. We'll get into that in a second. We'll totally get into that in a second.
So, you know, at first it was actually by myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I got, you know, I started to reach out to some other bloggers, and then a friend of mine figured out how to rip video off of TiVo. And
wow, TiVo.
Because I remember, you know, I was talking to him going, you know, it's like you could read the quotes of like a bit back then, Bill O'Reilly, right? He had the best cable ratings.
Mm-hmm.
And or, you know, Hannity and Combs, right? Yeah. Hannity. And it's like you can read these quotes, but if you see them, it's much more powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, I wish there was a way I could figure out how to do that. And then like a friend of mine goes, oh, guess what? And
mm-hmm.
There was these hacks that people had figured out how to hack into a TiVo, and sort of that was, and the light bulb went off. So I said, let's do, you know,
yeah.
I said, you mean you can download something and I can put like a 2-minute clip up? He goes, oh, you could probably do that. Get over here. You know?
Yeah. I mean, that had to have been exciting and daunting, because we're talking about what, 2005, 2006, and being able to host streaming video, especially embeddable streaming video, had to have been an enormous technical undertaking, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, it was. There was no infrastructure, right?
Right, so
it was kind of like we did it. We were like the first DIY kind of things happening as far as when it goes to internet. And what happened is a friend of mine was an editor at E! Entertainment, and he had been an editor at Fox Sports, and he was also a, you know, he wanted to, you know, he was writing some songs. And so, mm-hmm. So I was help. He didn't understand song form, you know?
Right.
So I said, well, I'll help you. And so we were talking about it, and he had basically saved, I think it was a program called Sonar, and he had saved the files. So then he came over, he goes, oh, they're, you know, they're, I store them up in a, you know, on some servers. And so that was that. So I actually wrote a song years ago that I posted. It was a goof on Bill O'Reilly.
Mm-hmm.
And we uploaded it. And so then when my other friend, my IT genius friend, told me about, well, I think I can hack into the TiVo. Okay, we made the video.
Mm-hmm.
So now how does everybody see it?
Right, right.
You know, like, okay, well, I could see it. So then, like, I realized I called, you know, I'll just call him Donnie. I said, Donnie, now you uploaded, you know, the songs up, you know, to us. I forget the name of the company. I mean, it's no longer around.
Right, right, sure.
Sold 10 times. And he goes, yeah, it's like $25 for 100 gigs or something, you know. And so I said, well, listen, if I upload something, can I put like a hyperlink on it? So that then when you click on it, it'll download it, you know?
Yeah.
And he goes, I think you can do that. So I uploaded. So then I just bought an account for $25, uploaded it. And then I put like click here to receive the video, and it worked. And I was like, holy shit. I mean, you know, and the first thing I actually did put up online was a Daily Show clip. And that was in October. I think it was October 19th of 2004.
Wow. 2004. And, that's incredible. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was sort of the start of it. And then I realized, like, you know, to me, again, it was all about exposing the liars in the media that were telling the people, you know, Saddam Hussein was going to nuke Cleveland,
mm-hmm.
you know, or, you know, and all the, you know, what got me started, you know, first, my first political awakening was the 2000 election when Florida, you know, and Catherine Harris, and then the Supreme Court basically gave the election to George Bush. So that was my first sort of, you know, real awakening mm-hmm. about what was happening. And then obviously, as we move forward, I said, you know, we need transparency, because the media wasn't even commenting on really much of Fox News outside of something or outrageous. And so then, you know, I said, you know, I got to keep doing this. Just, I mean, I didn't know what I was doing as far as how to get links from people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was all fair. I mean, I was fairly new into this. And then after a time, you know, it's like, you know, people realized, oh, wait, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then it just started to take off. And you know, that's 17, like, can you believe it's 17 years?
Yeah, it's mind-boggling, John. It really, really is that so much time has gone by. But we were all making it up as we went along. I mean, you were especially at the vanguard of all of that with video and everything like that. And the amazing thing about the video on Crooks and Liars is not only was it something that set you apart in terms of your content, but it was also something that was a convenient promotional tool, because, as I said, you could take those video clips and you could embed them into your own blog. Like, I remember embedding Crooks and Liars videos into my blog, which also spread the word about Crooks and Liars. It was like free advertising for your blog.
And right. So, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't like I planned on, wow, well, this is a great promotional tool. You know, that's just the way. And it's funny because one of my best friends, right, you know, he lived in California, you know, in Venice. And so when it started in 2005, it started to sort of take hold. And you know, I was off the road. I had been seriously injured by a doctor. I don't need to get into that.
Oh, my God.
So I was crippled for a while. And so I was disabled. You know, I couldn't. It was rough. I don't want to get into it. But so then he was saying, well, you know, what do you think you're going to do? You know, what's the, because I couldn't play music at that time. So I told him, I'm doing this. And he thought I was crazy. You know, like, wait, you're doing this. It's like,
what is this that you're talking about even?
But like, I realized,
there's a lot of head scratching, right? Like, what, a blog? What is a blog. That's a funny word.
Right, exactly. And you know, it was, it's funny, the term blogging, I think, actually came from Arianna Huffington, because, you know, I was good friends with Arianna for a long time. You know, and but it's like nobody used to say, well, I blogged this. It was Arianna who started doing that, you know. And so all of a sudden, well, I blog this. No, you write something, you post something. You know, I write on a blog, you know, but anyway, it was, you know, it, I mean, I'm so grateful for it, but it was, you know, it's funny. I actually, back in early 2005, I realized like what this was about, because, you know, I went from like, you know, 100, you know, hits a day on, back then it was SiteMeter. Actually, my first platform was Radio Userland, and then it went up to like 5,000 and then 6,000, and I was oh wow, this is pretty cool, you know. And I realized, I said, you know what, I mean, I don't have the resource. I kid you not, I actually called the corporate offices of Google and told them, I said, listen, I don't know who to talk to, but I have an idea as far as a video platform. You know, because they obviously had all the space, you know, and I just thought it's, and I got nowhere. It wasn't like I spent weeks trying to contact people, but I made some efforts, you know, and then it was funny, about a year later, suddenly like YouTube showed up, you know?
It seems like maybe you were way ahead of the curve on that.
Well, you know, I realized, you know, fairly quickly that this is an important step, because again, actually seeing what's being said and spoken instead of reading a quote is much more powerful.
Yeah.
And you know, especially, you know, watching these, you know, QAnon, you know, I don't even call them conservatives anymore. It's just right. QAnon Republicans. Mm. It's disgraceful, but you can't really, if you read it, you still have to see them to believe your eyes that people, I mean, there was a guy on yesterday, right, on Martha McCallum's show, is this guy, Ty Smith, and he was on, you know, they also, it's all performance, like grievance politics for these QAnon people now. There's no like legislation, there's no bills. It's all about attacking the left or finding some outrage. So the guy, this African-American guy, went on one of these, suddenly school board meetings are like Fox News's number one, you know,
target,
you know, to cover.
So
all of a sudden, oh, the outrage, the parents being taught critical race theory, and he starts screaming about it. So now it made his radio show bigger, and he was on with Martha McCallum's show on Fox News, and he basically said slavery was never about racism. So now just think about that. I mean, and Martha is just like, oh yeah, right, that, yeah, of course. Well, listen, it's really great having you on. The guy just said slavery wasn't about racism.
That's right.
And so, well, thank you for coming on. You know, it was lovely.
It's some next level madness going on there.
I mean, but it's, I mean, this is just one example of a thousand of where, you know, the, where they've devolved, you know? But anyway, so with the site, then, you know, and then after a couple of years, I actually was, I mean, you know, it's funny, people talk about getting Twitter flamed and all that stuff. But back, you know, before Twitter was around, it was our comment sections. And I remember going on CNN, and one of the you know, the hosts was saying, well, we hear that the comment section is like the Wild West, you know, and it's like, well, listen, there's groups called, like, there was one group called Fuck France, and these guys, you know, back then it was Halo Scan was basically the commenting platform that there was, and you can only ban 20 IP addresses. So if you get a group of 30 people, just, I mean, the stuff that they were doing in the comment sections, where they would put up like lynching pictures, right, constantly, also like, you know, old men, you know, having sex with each other. I mean, racist, homophobic, disgusting stuff that they would post in the comment section, and it was almost impossible to get rid of.
In fact, there were a lot of blogs that had just open comment areas. In fact, the Huffington Post started that way, where just, you didn't have to register, you didn't have to sign up. Anyone, literally anyone, could comment. So you would end up at the Huffington Post, and there would be, under a particular article, there would be thousands and thousands of comments, completely unmoderated. So all of the weirdo shit that you were just talking about would end up in the comment sections of some of these blogs. It was an incredible period of time, especially given now where you have to register and there's admins and it's very well curated. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but they still, you know, as comment sections and websites and security gets better, so do the trolls.
Yeah.
So do the Russian bots. Right. Mm-hmm. So do the ransomware scumbags from overseas. So they just find ways to get around and to spoof. And it's always a problem. But I laugh when, like, I'll see, an NRA person complain. What was the name? Dana. Right. They're being mean to me on Twitter. And it's like, you know how many death threats I received?
Oh yeah.
I can't even tell you I would get emails if I find you, I'll gas you, I'll put your head in the oven.
Me too.
It was just insane, just in the comment sections alone, let alone the emails that I would get. It's funny because I had saved a lot of them, and then and I was not a computer whiz at the time, and so the hard drive went and I lost all these. I put them on a notepad, And so I lost stuff from like 2005 till 2008 or something. But it was horrendous. And the stuff that I see now, like, you talk about snowflakes. I've never seen the biggest whiners in my life are the Republicans online. It's crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, back then it was a free for all, and we did our best. Mm-hmm. To monitor that. But my goal was getting content out.
Oh yeah.
To keep being transparent, and we didn't just focus on Fox News. I mean, back in the early days, like a lot of the media, I mean, MSNBC hired Tucker Carlson.
Yeah, I remember that.
Right? That was after George Bush won re-election, and I called and I got through to a producer there, and I said, "I don't understand why are you hiring Tucker Carlson?" And the guy's going, "Look at the map." And I'm going, "What map?" "The election map." So, the Fox News map, how they
look at all that red.
Right. Even though they got like 40 million less people that they represent. Mm. Right. They have more, barren land.
Yeah.
So it's like, look at the map. And it's like, what are you talking about? They had Joe Scarborough on. Right. And he had a Scarborough country. I mean, he sort of changed a bit because Trump was too odious even for him. But
God, so, Scarborough country. Oh my God, Scarborough country. I completely forgot about that.
Yeah, people remember like the Mel Gibson, right, Passionate of Christ movie. That started a big evangelical website thing where they'd have these, big websites. So like he had guests on from all these Passionate of Christ movie fans. Mm-hmm. And yes, well, I own a bookstore and I have 11 kids.
Yeah.
And liberals are horrible, mm-hmm. And so, hey, liberals are horrible. She said it right here, folks. They'd have Bill Donahue on from the Catholic League, there was no pedophilia in the church, it was what it was. So the whole media, even through CNN, Lou Dobbs was on CNN for years upon years, and it was until finally they couldn't take his xenophobia anymore, because he was doing that whole that Mexico wants to, take over Texas and get their land back, the Reconquistadores. I forget exactly what it's called. So once he started doing that, they finally kicked him off. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, he found his home.
Yeah.
On Fox Business. And then because you can just do whatever you want. But CNN, MSNBC, they were all sort of imitating Fox News at the time. I mean, there were some good programs on those networks. Mm-hmm. But remember, Phil Donahue got kicked off.
I remember that. Because
he criticized the Iraq War.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. I've been dying to ask you, John, about how blogging has changed, how social media has affected blogging. And one of the things that I think we could end up seeing in the not too distant future is with social media, it kind of, in a sense, replaced some blogs, right? It didn't replace all blogs. There's still plenty of blogs. Obviously, Crooks and Liars is still around, going strong. But social media has kind of eked in on that space a little bit. But I think with the fact that social media isn't necessarily owned by the creators anymore, where you own Crooks and Liars. There are lots of bloggers who still own their own platform, but with social media, you're kind of at the whimsy of people like Mark Zuckerberg and Twitter and so on. But I think that's going to create a backlash, and I believe that more people are going to go back to owning their own blogs. What do you think about that? Do you think it's going to come full circle again?
Well, I hope so. You know, because we are, you know, you hear about the right wing grievances about how they're canceling out all conservative voices. Meanwhile, mm-hmm. they're all on Twitter still, you know, yeah. and just complaining because, you know, they can't spread conspiracy theories, you know. But what's happened is with Mark Zuckerberg, you know, people don't know this. I've written about it because we just ran a fundraising drive, and we're going to do another one after the summer, because what they do is they change their algorithms with no, and they don't tell you what it's about. So then suddenly you'll have all this traffic. Then they decide, well, we're not putting this in politics anymore. Mm-hmm. And our content, you know, if you look at NewsGuard, which is sort of the new, like, they're arbiters of who's spreading conspiracy theories.
Yeah.
You know, we get high marks. I mean, because that's always been the key to the success of Crooks and Liars. First, having great, you know, editors. Carol Lee Coons is wonderful.
Oh, yeah. She's the best. Yeah.
And Fran and the rest of the team, you know, and, you know, Elise Worthing. They really, you know, and Scarce, they really, you know, do the job and work really hard. Mm-hmm. You know, it's gotten harder and harder because, like, suddenly we'll lose, you know, 50,000 page views for why? Like, Reddit decides, well, you know, now we're not going to use any other news sites except for this.
Yeah.
So then, you know, I mean, like, a lot of the other, you know, mainstream, like, we'll call them websites, right, from Mediaite, and all the right-wing sites and Politico, they get tons of traffic from Drudge Report. Mm-hmm. I think he basically keeps them all afloat.
Yes, you know, because, he does.
Because he's a tremendous aggregator of content.
Mm-hmm.
And the left has no function like that anymore.
Right.
You know, Huffington Post tried to do that for a while. But and then, of course, they made changes
sold it to AOL. And that was the end of that.
Right. So it used to be more of a, like, where we would share each other's comments and links and go, wow, check this out, you mm-hmm. know, where because of the advent of social media, it made it harder to get advertising dollars.
Mm-hmm.
Also with political campaigns, you know, I wrote a big article back in the 2012 election at the Washington Post I was interviewed about, because suddenly, you know, we do news. We do a lot of opinion, but the one thing is our journalistic ethics cannot be questioned.
Right.
And so we don't, you know, we're not making, you know, when Breitbart first started, his first big thing was he edited, you know, an Obama appointee and made it look like she said one thing when she didn't, mm-hmm. you know, like, and that's the one thing, you know, I would always say, listen, we need extra time on that video so people see a little more, as opposed to, I, you know, putting up 10 seconds or something. That's, you can just edit that, make anybody look bad, you
right.
know. And so they've taken, so what happened is, because of Google's rise, they now own and take over all the advertising revenue.
Yep.
So these consultants come in and tell, you know, President Obama and Mitt Romney, well, let's just do these cheap targeted ads. There's no first party ads anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and all the unions and everyone else was just advertising through Google ads. And so it really hurt revenues for, if you're not a big corporate entity, or if you don't have the Mercers funding you, you know, or the Koch brothers, you know, the Coors family.
Yeah.
You know, it made it much more difficult moving forward.
Yeah, it really
did. So that's a big problem, you know, now for a lot of blogs like myself and a lot of others, where it, with, you got Mark Zuckerberg and the Daily Caller, aka Tucker Carlson, mm-hmm. is a fact checker.
Right. And, you know, the other thing, speaking of Zuckerberg, is Facebook used to be a great platform for promoting your blog, right? If you had your own website, you could post a link to it on Facebook. It would hit all of your Facebook friends. People would see it. And in fact, for some reason, Facebook, above all of the other social media platforms, is the platform that people used to use to click on links. If you put a link up on Facebook, there's like a far greater chance of someone clicking on that link than posting the same link on Twitter or any of the other social media platforms. So for the longest time, Facebook was this great way to drive traffic to your blog. But then right. Suddenly, I can only imagine how you guys were affected by this. When they changed the algorithm, I believe it was in late 2013, it completely choked off all the traffic to a lot of these independent blogs and websites. So Mark Zuckerberg not only built up traffic for our sites, certainly Crooks and Liars, but then also pulled the rug out from under all of us at a particular point. Did you guys get affected by that change in the algorithm?
Yes, we did. But they keep changing them over time.
Yeah.
So we weren't, at that time, we weren't, Facebook wasn't our main driver of traffic. So we didn't rely on them totally. Remember, there used to be a site called Dig.
Yeah.
And so they used to, they were great aggregators.
Yep.
Mimeo Random is still around, but they don't really aggregate much traffic. Mm-hmm. So, sure, you're always looking at links and, we were quoted all over the place from the New York Times and the Post and all different news networks. And, obviously, they won't admit it, but I knew a bunch of producers from CNN and MSNBC and, they would use our websites to produce segments. Mm-hmm. Because we had been working like crazy the night before early in the morning, you know? And so with these algorithm changes, and here's the thing, it frustrates me the most too. You got Facebook is worth, who knows, $10 to $100 trillion. Mm-hmm. And even Twitter.
Yeah.
And YouTube. You try to get a customer service person.
Good luck.
Have you ever tried?
Oh yeah.
It's like insane.
Yeah.
That they just like they'll make a move and then that's it. And so they can just say, well, you're banned or you're suspended or we're changing this algorithm. You get no explanation.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just gotten worse year after year.
Yes, it has.
And it's harder right now. It is harder. And that's why we have a subscription service now. If people just want to subscribe, if they want to get ad free, they can join in and it's $50 for the year.
Mm-hmm.
And that will help keep us going.
Yeah.
And again, we have to adapt. But, we don't have, it's the one thing I have a big complaint about the left, and I've written about it and I've talked to people in meetings. Like we get, the big left wing donors and what they believe is if they donate to a political candidate, that's it. They're done.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where if you look at the right, the only reason why the right has been as successful is because they run a ground game 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, and they fund everybody. People that are kicked out, that have been found out to be plagiarists, 2 years later, they start a group called The Federalist, and now they're on Fox News every day. How is that possible? Because they're getting shadow funded, right? And, and of course, it's hard to even find out who's funding these people.
Mm-hmm. Well, they treat their content like a commodity. They sell it by any means possible, whether it's bulk book buying or 99% of every Red Hat platform out there is buying traffic, buying followers, buying likes, buying shares. You can buy all of this stuff in the open market. I mean, you can go and buy podcast downloads if you want. And so everything is artificially inflated. But what that does is it gives them this level of prestige and artificial attention that they're able to use and exploit and build up their base because of all of that. And it's immensely frustrating because on the left, you don't necessarily have that infrastructure, right?
No, exactly. And they've been doing this, since the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And since Goldwater.
Yeah.
And And so suddenly, like, the mantra has been going on, tax cuts, tax, that's all they come, that's, you know, that's their thing. Tax cuts fits everything. Well, you know, how did that even happen? And you have to read some history and find out that they just keep doing the same things. It started first with mail order, you know, sending out mail, the big mail king. And then it's grown to where we are today. And it's very frustrating because, you know, because we have the same beliefs. I mean, our focus is on the working class of this country, right? 99% of this country. And so do a lot of, you know, we'll call them Democratic millionaires and billionaires, but they, I'm not sure why they don't see the correlation that if you want an honest message delivered, you need to, you just can't go on MSNBC one time and think like that's gonna do it, you know. You need to be promoting the working class and that messaging constantly.
Oh yeah, so, you need to support the influencers as much as the political campaigns. I think most of the left's money goes into political campaigns, and that's fine. I'm glad that that's happening, but at the same time, you have to also promote, I think, and help and to boost financially the people who are establishing the agendas, establishing the talking points, getting the word out there, authors, podcasters, bloggers, writers, you know, et cetera, down the line. That's what the Red Hats are doing. That's what the current Trump Republicans have been doing. And as you said, this has been going on the right since, well, for 50 years at least.
Oh, absolutely. And it's not going to change. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, it's funny because the pandemic, you know, obviously affected lots of people in a lot of different ways, but with the QAnon Republicans, it's a cult. It's really not. It's not about the Constitution. It's not about any of, you know, the Bill of Rights or the flag. Mm-hmm. It's really about an autocratic buffoon that now they bow down to.
Yeah,
and it's. And like, I just, it's funny. I clipped Newt Gingrich the other day and we used it in a different article, but I'm actually writing a quick article. And, you know, Newt was one of the first purveyors of lies and conspiracy theories and outrages that, I mean, it got him kicked out pretty fast as being Speaker of the House.
Right.
But, and he just went on and said, well, look, you know, these voting machines, you know, they're programmed to steal votes for Democrats.
That's right.
Yeah. And it's like, what? Like, and he, and of course, these Fox News cohorts don't say anything, but yeah, that's probably, I mean, he actually says voting machines steal votes. Yeah. Right. And so it's, you know, machines steal, he said, machines steal. So it's now for the right-wing extremists, it's not, was the election stolen, but of course, I mean, you know, of course it was stolen. Mm-hmm. I mean, look, voting machines, you can't even trust voting machines.
Yeah.
You can't trust anything outside of cyber ninjas, you know, taking over the voting structure of every state.
Yeah. Yeah. These guys have always been really good at the, I know you are, but what am I defense. Take whatever the left is saying, reverse it and redirect it back at the left. Right. So if Republicans are stealing elections, all the Republicans say, well, it's a Democrat stealing elections. See.
Right.
And it's no, of course, it's like, not
there'll
that
be.
Way.
Yeah. Yeah. There'll be 100 examples. Look, you know, the last like a couple of years, the only people convicted of voter fraud have been Republicans, you know, over and over again. And also the whole QAnon child pornography, drinking the blood of children. You know, the only people that have been convicted of that are people that are on the QAnon websites.
That's right.
So, I mean, they are really good at that. And what I've been writing and, you know, telling that we need Democratic politicians to start fighting fire with fire. I said this, I've been saying this for 15 years, because you have the truth on your side, you have the facts on your side, but you just can't tell people, well, you know, 37% of the time, you know, this happens, but you know, people support this by 59%. And then with the, you know, and if we carry over the three, that means that people like this better than, you know, you have to fight. These people are fascists.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have to go on and just say it the way it is. You know, remember when Alan Grayson, a few years ago, right during the Obama, the healthcare, when he said Republicans just want you to get sick and die.
Yeah.
Right. That's like a blip on the scale of what Republicans, how they talk today. But
I know. Then, oh, my God.
The entire media was outraged. Yeah. Chuck Todd, how dare he? CNN, NBC, ABC. That was like the worst thing. How dare you say Republicans want to, you know, want to do that to people?
Yeah.
Now their whole structure is about dehumanizing everybody on the left.
Right.
So it's not. So if they talk about Kamala Harris, she's an idiot. She's stupid. Like they don't even, there's no respect for any political office if you're their opponent.
Okay, we'll get back to our conversation with John Amato here in just one second. But first, here's a word from Stephanie Miller.
Well, do you ever catch yourself thinking when you're looking in the mirror, I wish those under eye bags would just go away. You're not alone. Bags and puffiness under the eyes are a problem for millions of American men and women. Until now, introducing the new Genucel Serum with plant stem cell technology from Chamonix. Susan from New Jersey wrote me, I've been using Genucel for a couple of months. The puffiness around my eyes is gone. Even the crow's feet and small lines have disappeared and haven't come back. I love this product. I use it under my eyes, around my cheekbones, and on my eyelids. With its instant effects, Chamonix says you'll see results in the first 12 hours or your money back. I love it. I use the entire line of products. It is my favorite skincare I've ever used. They guarantee it, though. Results in the first 12 hours or your money back. Order now. Get 50% off all Genucel packages for summer. Go to lovegenucel.com/Stephanie. That's love, GENUCEL.com/Stephanie. lovegenucel.com/Stephanie. I use it every single day. I get so many compliments. Check it out. lovegenucel.com/Stephanie.
The Bob Seska Show.
It's amazing. Back in 2006 or so, we were all talking about how completely bananas the Republican Party had become. But I don't think any of us could have predicted that Republican politics would continue to disintegrate into this cuckoo's nest that it's become. I mean, if someone had traveled back in time, John, to 2006 and informed us that in 2020, Trump would be president, Donald Trump would be president, and after allowing 600,000 Americans to die from a global pandemic, he'd end up getting 74 million votes anyway. I mean, I wouldn't have believed that time traveler. I would have said, you're crazy. What are you talking about? That's Donald Trump. That's crazy talk, right? I mean, we couldn't have predicted it would get this crazy.
Back in 2006, you know, I completely agree with you. But back in 2010, Dave Nyrat was my managing editor at the time. We co-wrote a book called Over the Cliff, How the Election of Barack Obama Drove the Right Insane.
Yeah.
And what I'll just boil it down, the election of a black man to the Oval Office really flipped out the kingmakers of the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. And listen, there's always been, if you go throughout history, remember, people don't realize the KKK was a political party in this country.
Yeah.
That was a right-wing religious party, right? They were doing it for God, you know, or that was what they said.
Yeah.
And so they've always had extremists all over the place. I mean, you just go to, even with Alex Jones and 9/11 was an inside job, right? Mm-hmm. That was a big deal. It was a lot bigger than the media let on, but at least 20-25% of the people back then thought it was an inside job, you know?
Yeah.
And so what they did, they were so afraid of Obama's his charisma, that they let the nuts out of the Jack in the Box. And that's when you saw the summer of hate, the whole healthcare debate, when what they're doing now, they did then, which is if a Democratic congressperson was holding a town hall, they just overran it and were violent and spitting and attacking people.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, you know, you're taking away my Medicare. What are you talking about? You know, that's a socialist program. And so what we wrote is that this is only going to get worse.
Mm-hmm.
Because now they let the nuts out of their cages and now they can't pull them back.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
So they let, you know, back in the 90s, right, the black helicopter crowd, the militia movement, now these people are, you know, marching on streets. I mean, they tried to kidnap the governor of Michigan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's why it was
think about that.
Yeah. I mean, that's why it was so important, I think, for websites like yours to be covering the batshit crazy people on the fringe of the right. And I get this a lot. Why do you pay attention to people like Alex Jones, Bob? And I said, well, look, Donald Trump was the Alex Jones president. Make no mistake about it. The crazy people have taken over the chicken coop. I mean, this is what has happened to the Republican Party, and we've watched it happen in real time over the last 20 years. Those of us have been writing about it, and it's just staggering to see how far it's devolved and how cynical it's become too, John. I mean, the approach now is we don't care if any of this makes any sense. As long as we're winning the day, that's all that matters. That's the only thing that matters to the Republic. That's why one day, I mean, there have been paragraphs in which Donald Trump, there have been sentences, in fact, where Donald Trump has contradicted by the end of the sentence what he started out by saying at the beginning of the sentence. You know what I mean? But it doesn't matter, does it?
No, no. Listen, you know, Mr. Peach, television, radio, cloud. Yeah. Water president, right? right. I mean, it's mind-boggling.
Mm-hmm.
But that this narcissistic buffoon got to where he got. But it's not, if you thought about it in 2006.
Yeah.
But not moving on, like when Trump, you know, people forget that he helped develop Fox Business, but also he was the king of the birthers, right? And the whole media laughed at him,
mm-hmm.
right? Oh, I'm going to find Obama's real birth certificate, right? He was, I mean, look, we know his racist history, but that was, the smart thing that he does is he listens to the hate AM radio,
mm-hmm.
And also his Fox News shows. And so then he takes the most vile things that they say, and that became his platform.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, now when you watch, you know, because when Roger Ailes was alive, right, he tried to put out a glitzy, shiny product, right, fair and balanced.
Yeah.
And now it's basically the same thing as turning on AM radio back in the 90s.
Yeah. Yeah. No one talks about the fact that Donald Trump is the world's greatest knockoff artist. Even the birther thing, John, he just stole that wholesale from Orly Tates. Remember Orly Tates? She was the birther woman. She was the one who popularized. In fact, you know, Mark Halperin was the guy who mainstreamed the birther movement by writing about it in Time magazine, in his column in Time magazine. And that became a thing. He actually recommended it to John McCain in the 2008 campaign. Here's how you can win, John McCain. Make a big deal out of Barack Hussein Obama's middle name and heritage.
Right.
That was Mark Halperin. And that became Donald Trump's thing because he stole it. He stole it from all those guys. He's stolen the Fox News platform too. I mean, that's the MAGA agenda. It's Fox, whatever's on Fox News, that's the MAGA agenda. So, and that hardly gets any coverage, does it?
No, I you know, that really, I mean, just look how many people he hired from Fox News.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then the people would go on Fox News and just say what he wanted to hear, hoping they'd either get a job or they'd get invited, or maybe they had a friend that wanted to be pardoned. It goes on and on. I've never seen really something quite like this.
It's incredible.
We haven't. But again, it was in 2010, Dave and I predicted that this would only get worse and worse.
Yeah.
And it has. And now where we have QAnon candidates that say, well, if you want me to get vaccinated, that means, you know, I need to, you know, that you're treating me, you know, as if you're a Nazi and I'm in a concentration camp.
Yeah.
I mean, that's where we are.
By the way, I want to emphasize Dave Nywert one more time, because he's one of the best writers, one of the best political writers of our time. He wrote a great book called The Eliminationists, which set the standard as far as examining right-wing violence, which we're now seeing. I mean, he basically called shit like the insurrection years and years ago, that this is the direction that the parties, and then the book that you guys wrote together completely forecasted a lot of the crap that we're seeing now. And I want to make sure that we all give you credit for that, not only giving us Dave Nywert. So I want to make sure that that's emphasized.
Yeah, he was great. We're still good friends.
Yeah.
And, you know, we did a lot of, we went to a lot of conferences together.
Yeah.
And then we promoted the book together at times. And it's what's funny is when you'll get like the progressive writers on New Yorker or some of the other magazines,
mm-hmm.
it's like it takes them 2-3 years to come to the same conclusion that we did.
Yeah.
And then when they write about it, it's like, oh, my God, look what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know what, John? We have been right about so many things. The left, liberal writers, Democratic writers, however you want to define us as a rather large big tent group. We've been right about everything from the 2000 campaign to the Iraq War to 9/11 to WMD to the failure of the George W. Bush administration, the incoming Great Recession that occurred beginning in 2007-2008. We were way ahead of the curve on that. I remember Tom Hartman predicting that years before. So yeah, this is the sort of thing where I feel like, and it's a point of frustration for me, because I feel like, as you said, more people should be paying attention to people like you, John, and Dave Nywert and Carolee Coons, and the people who are observing these things from a place of what I believe to be a factual basis. And that doesn't get recognized nearly enough.
No, and also, you know, Digby, you know, had the part.
Oh, yeah, Digby, absolutely.
Spot. Mm-hmm. She also writes for Salon. She's one of our best writers.
Yeah.
She knows the history of politics,
right,
as well as anyone.
Yeah.
And she writes beautifully. She's a good friend. Josh Marshall was also really
Josh Marshall.
To,
I mean, there was Ezra Klein, Marcos Melitzis, the guys at Balloon
friend,
Juice,
you know, Marcos,
Oliver Willis.
Very,
yeah.
Yeah. Marcos and Daily Coast has been very kind to Crooks and Liars. Back when we were getting started, Josh Marshall was very kind to Crooks and Liars. And so I'm very appreciative of all of them, you know, and Digby, I call her Digby just because that, you know, people didn't even know she was, you know, a woman for a year.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, I'll always refer to Duncan Black as Atrios. So,
right. Yeah.
And Duncan, blogging him, yeah.
I know. And then a good friend of mine, Howie Klein, you know, he's like my older brother.
Oh,
and
yeah.
We have a political pact together, the three of us, called Blue America, where we try to find really good progressive candidates and promote them. Mm-hmm. And it's not about being a political pact that scores victory after victory, because the media likes that, right? Oh, yeah. You know, 7 out of 10 of their candidates won. we realize that we're trying to get the message out. And so not every district that we're going to basically back somebody is going to be a blue district or a purple district. We're going to try to get a progressive message in a red district.
Yeah.
You know, to explain that, we should lower the age of Medicare. Right. If it wasn't for Joe Lieberman, Medicare would have been lowered to 50.
Yeah. Right.
And can you imagine the healthcare savings of this country if that had happened?
Oh, yeah.
If
Joe Lieberman had allowed a public option into the Affordable Care Act, healthcare would be a lot different, too. Yeah.
No, absolutely. But remember, he was the deciding vote when, to you know, 3 months prior to this vote, he was all for expanding Medicare. But he was angry because the grassroots of the left basically made him lose his Senate race because he was such a warmonger.
Mm-hmm.
So, it goes that way, you know, so we know what the right message is. We know what's going to help the people. And so that's what Blue America does. And I've been in it for we've been in it now for over 10 years, 12 years, maybe 13 years. And so we have a good record of backing really good progressive candidates. And so I just want to give a shout out to Howie because he does really great work.
Yeah.
And anyway, so yeah, it's just, I mean, today, every day is a new dawn with the insanity, you know. And again, you talked about why should anybody, look at Alex Jones or listen to, well, look where we are today. I mean, you should just ignore them.
Yeah, right.
You know, I've been hearing that for 17, well, let's say 16 years.
Me
right?
too. Me too.
Yeah. I mean, you know, look where we are.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have now 607,000, right? Over 607,000 people dead. And now the states that are Trump supporters are the ones that are being infected and dying.
Right, right.
More than anybody else.
It doesn't make any sense. Yeah.
So, you know, and yet Fox News is still running craziness every day.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this vaccine, you know, now they call it what's Tucker's latest attack on vaccine? You know, we're coming to your house.
Tucker doesn't attack. Tucker asks ridiculous questions.
Right.
What is a vaccine anyway? What is racism? What is this word racism? What's even the definition of that? It's just like,
but have you ever heard of white supremacy before? What's a neo-Nazi? I'm just asking.
You know what? I'm dying to talk a little bit about you and your career, because you have had an incredible journey through your life. It's remarkable to look at some of the things that you've done in your life as far as not just political blogging, but also music. So where did you grow up? Because I recognize the accent. So
I grew up in Astoria, Queens.
There you go. Yeah. Are both of your folks Italian, or just your one?
Yeah,
one
I'm like a Sicilian. I think my sister did one of those, DNA things. And we're about as Sicilian as humanly possible, whatever the,
Incredible. So you're not Italian. You are Sicilian. There's a big difference.
I call myself an Italian American. Yeah. My grandparents came in like 1918.
Right. Oh, my God.
And the racism that they faced, just this one thing. The racism was so bad against them that they learned that they were here before they had children. They learned English after X amount of years. And then when the kids were born, they only spoke English because they didn't want the kids speaking Italian outside because they would have been attacked.
Yeah.
So I remember, when I was, taking Spanish in high school, it's like, I'd ask my parents, why don't we speak Italian? It bothered me. And, I asked my grandfather, he said, people were attacking us. I mean, people don't realize that. And I'm not, this isn't a comparison, but Italians were being lynched.
Mm-hmm.
There's a new Yogi, the great Yogi biography, Yogi Berra, and they talk about that. So because of racism back then, my sister and I do not speak Italian, and we should.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Both of my grandparents came over about the same time as your grandparents. And my dad grew up in a household where both of his parents spoke Italian. His grandparents spoke Italian, but it wasn't taught to the kids. So my dad's generation didn't get any of that. In fact, my dad's had to go to class to learn Italian in later life to get caught up. So it's a pretty amazing thing. Things have changed quite significantly, I think, for immigrants since then. But, I assume, too, that most people who visit your website, Crooks and Liars, don't know that you're an accomplished professional musician. When did you first fall in love with music, John?
Well, as a kid, I just remember I have a very good memory. And so I remember in the second grade, we went to a classroom and there were all these instruments and I saw a violin. And I said, wow, I want to play that, And of course, I was in the second grade and I couldn't get it. But then I just always had that, I was always interested in wanting to play an instrument. I don't know why. I used to listen to as a child, right? Top 40, Cousin Brucey and all that kind of stuff, it was back then, I don't know how it is now in schools when you go to high school, but they gave at the sixth grade, they had us all in the auditorium and they gave us this test, right? They had all the graduating class. Mm-hmm. And I guess it was just a basic music class. So, cause they would figure out who should go to shop, who has a little talent in art, who can do this. And so then in the seventh grade, I was put in the junior band.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I won't get into it all, but I wound up getting the trombone, which I hated. And it wasn't until my senior year that I went to the beginning band, and I wanted the flute because it was light and I could take it on the bus with me, and I got the saxophone.
Oh, really? So it was the saxophone almost by default, huh?
Exactly. I didn't really choose it. And then, a couple months into the class, the teacher said, you have some music ability. My friend Mike Rod, he's a Juilliard, monster, you should take lessons with him. And then Mike Rod became my first sort of music mentor.
Wow, and that's incredible.
He's passed away since. He was a tremendous musician. And
Yeah, when you studied you also studied with Andrew Loyola from the New York Ballet, didn't you? Was that before or after school? College.
Well, when I went to I went to Hunter College.
Yeah,
and I went there. I wasn't planning on. I was playing, to be honest with you, in my first band, in the disco era, 1976.
Wow.
But I was going to minor in music.
Yeah.
And I was taking lessons, but I wanted to be a writer, but also, you know, they give you, when you graduate or getting high school, they give you this aptitude test and it's like hundreds of questions, you know, again, to help you get an idea of what you might should go into in college. And it told me I should be a psychotherapist, a psychologist, or a psychiatrist. So I said, well, maybe I should. So I took a basic psychology class. Uh-huh. And then, you know, I found the jazz band, the jazz workshop. And so then I just on a whim, you know, I had Mike had told me that, you know, if you want to continue with this, you're going to have to learn how to play the flute and the clarinet. And at the time I hated the clarinet,
yeah.
But I guess I had an affinity for the flute. I was playing it not very long. And so then they had this audition at Hunter College for a Carnegie Hall scholarship. And I learned a Bach flute sonata, and, you know, three of us were picked, and I was one of the people that won the scholarship.
Yeah.
And so then, yeah, luckily, I had one teacher that was terrible. Like one of these, you know, there are some classical people that, are very full of themselves.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Like in anywhere. But, and then when I got to Andrew, it was a godsend. He was the principal flutist for the New York City Ballet.
Yeah.
And he had a studio in Carnegie Hall. And so it was unbelievable going to Carnegie Hall.
I can't imagine. Oh my God.
And like, because there's, you know, people, it's not just a concert hall. There's tons of practice rooms and all, you know, all these different little suites and offices. And it was incredible. And he was such a great man. Just such a, he was almost like a hippie in a way. He wasn't a hippie, but he had longer hair. Mm-hmm. He was just so like, you know, I can't say, you know, how much I love that guy.
Yeah.
And even after I had graduated, he would still, like, he wouldn't even charge me for a lesson.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I'd be in his studio for 2.5 hours. He goes, listen, I'm not taking your money because this is my space. He goes, when I go into a session or, you know, if I'm playing for the ballet or if I'm doing a recording session, they tell me what to do. So you can't tell me what to do in my own space.
That's incredible. Were you intimidated by being in that climate, especially at Carnegie Hall with this famous music guy, New York Ballet?
No, really. Yeah. No, I mean, it was because I wanted to learn, you know, yeah. Like at first, you know, and I've learned a lot, obviously, over the years. And I think I'll make a generalization. Most people who get a good job don't believe they deserve it half the time, or they don't think they're smart enough. And, you know, and so when I won the scholarship, because there are people there, you know, much older than me that, I mean, to me, played better than I did. And they were pissed off that I got the scholarship, you know?
Sure,
and,
sure.
And so I'm going, well, I don't know why I got the scholarship. Maybe they just like me or something, you know, that's really seriously went through my head, you know, but when I went, I was just, it was so mad. It was so great going into the Carnegie Hall. He was such a great guy. And, it was a wonderful experience. I was never intimidated because, you know, we started with a Paul Hindemith flute sonata, and you know, his teaching technique, we were just simpatico, you know what I mean? And plus, you know, it's funny. I don't know how your listeners, you know, view ballet dancers, or, you know, I just always had this impression that ballet dancers were these little waifs, you know, and I got on the elevator.
People. Yeah, yeah.
I got on the elevator, you know, with all these ballet dancers, and they towered over me, and like, I have the most respect for dancers probably than almost anything, mm-hmm. You know, I mean, the incredible shape, but the discipline and, you know, and he told me, cause I was like, I was stunned. It's like, wow, I can't believe the physical, you know, shape that they're in. And, you know, and he's going, man, it's hell. If they, you know, stub their toe, they could be out for a season.
Yeah.
You know, I also played down at NYU for this Margaret Beals. She was an improvisational dance expert, and I played flute with these improvisational dancers from around the world that came to study with her, and that was unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, so I just love dancers. Anyway, so that's sort of, you know, and also I met Milt Hinton, who was a famous jazz bass player who ran the Jazz Workshop. And I didn't know anything about jazz. You know, I was a rocker.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, it took my ears a while to sort of come around to changes, because I was used to, you know, I grew up on Aqualung and Led Zeppelin and mm-hmm. Jimi Hendrix, and Frank Zappa was my hero too. And, you know, and,
yeah.
you know, Layla. And anyway, so, so he was a big influence on me. And then, you know, then I graduated, I started to do some teaching, and then you just go out into the world and start playing.
Yeah. So was the first step, as far as getting to popular music, was the first step becoming a session musician? Were you doing a lot of sessions at the time?
Well, back in New York, I mean, I played a lot of, you know, I got into bands to make money. So yeah. I did a lot of parties and corporate functions.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually, and I was writing original music with some good friends of mine, but it was actually, I came out to California up in the Bay Area. I didn't really plan to stay here, but I liked it. And there were these JJ Blues clubs up there.
Yeah.
I don't even know if many of them are around anymore. And this guy, Tom Castro, who's a Bay Area award winning blues artist, and he took me under his wing, and I started playing up there. And then I came to California, and that's when I sort of started meeting, you know, some sort of superstars. I met John Taylor, probably 97.
Duran Duran, yeah.
Right, because, you know, and so then he asked, you know, and with some other friends. And then, you know, he said, hey, you know, you want to do a session for me? You know, I said, sure. And then he put together an original band in 98. And so I joined his band. And then through that, I met other people. And, you know, I got to, you know, I have this, my prized possession is I did a couple of sessions for Ringo Starr.
Oh, yeah.
And and because Mark Hudson was his producer, and Mark had heard me play with John. So he goes, hey, man, you know, I got this great studio over in Santa Monica. Why don't you do some stuff for me? I was like, sure. Great. You know? And so he wrote a bunch of stuff for Ringo Starr. And so I got to play in a couple of tracks, and I got to meet him, become friends, and Ozzy Osbourne and all those kinds of guys.
Oh, it's incredible.
And actually, you know, when his wife, Ozzy's wife got that first, when she was doing that talk show.
Yeah. Sharon. Yeah.
Right. When Sharon got the talk show, Mark had written the theme song and all the cues. And I came in and did the demo for him. And Ozzy was there. And so all he did is just yell, Sharon, in the middle of the theme, you know.
Right. Of course he did.
I mean, he was really the nicest, funniest guy, you know. I mean, and we were laughing in the studios. And so if you see an old rerun and mm-hmm. you hear the end, the theme song, you hear my little sax solo at the end.
But, that's just so great. So when did you first hook up with Duran Duran? Because I mean, you ended up touring with those guys. Was that in the 80s or was it later?
No. This was, in other words, they reformed.
Yeah.
I mean, like 2000, I don't know if it was 2002 or mm-hmm. 2003. And because John, you know, John was going for record deals, and we played for three, four years.
Yeah.
And so then they reformed finally. And so one day, you know, I just, I got a call from John. He goes, hey, you know, we're playing down at the Blockbuster Bowl. There's this big, like, British explosion concert.
Yeah.
I go, yeah. He goes, you want to do the solo on Rio?
It's wow. Like,
yeah, of course. Why not? You know, so I learned the solo Rio, and so I, you know, there was like 70,000, I don't know, it was this huge venue where every British superstar, you know, it was promoted, I believe, by the radio station.
Mm-hmm.
And it was this massive concert, and you know, so they did their set. I had to wait to the end, and then after I played with them, they're like, hey, we're playing in Santa Barbara tomorrow, you want to do it? Yeah, sure. And then they were going, listen, we're going to San Francisco on Sunday, we're playing a 103.7, you know, concert there in the park. I go, sure. And so that's what happened. Then suddenly, like, you know, we got to get you on a few more songs, you know. So
right. So now so you're then, the touring saxophonist, right?
So it was great. I mean, John, you know, I can't sing enough praises to John Taylor. He's just you know, I owe him a lot. He's just a great guy. He was a great friend. And the guys in the band were really kind. And then, you know, we did a few other dates. And then they were doing the House of Blues in Chicago for like 3 days or a week. I forget. So then they asked me to do that. And then, you know, then I went to, I played down in Atlantic City with them, San Diego. And then we went to New Zealand and Australia, and that was awesome.
Oh, my God. So what was it like touring with those guys? Was there a lot, I guess the question is, was there a lot of partying when you...
Oh, you know, I mean, it's not like everybody was 20 years old, so
yeah, that's what I mean, yeah.
No, I mean, you know, John had recently been married, and the drummer was a great guy. Another last name was Taylor. Mm-hmm. So all of the guys were married.
Yeah.
And they were, you know, they treated me with class. And look, these guys, you know, were stars for a long time, and they knew how to tour. Yeah. And they knew how you behave, you know, and how you act.
And how you can survive it. I mean, that had to have been the main thing. Like,
yeah, like I said, they were just, you know, great to me. And so, and, you know, the good thing is, you know, when I went to Australia, New Zealand, they put me in, you know, in other words, people tour, right? When you're on a big tour, you hear about, you know, have you seen Almost Famous? There's a new extended version released. It's too long. Just watch the old movie, because two and a half hours is too much for that movie. But it's a great movie. But you got, you know, your roadies and sound techs and managers. And especially we were playing big soccer fields. And so it was pretty wild. But I got to stay in the, you know, in the main suites and the big hotels.
That's so great.
And, you know, and we'd like, let's say we had a day off, we'd go up the coast and go on these boats and stuff. It was really great, you know? And again, I can't thank them enough. And, it was a wonderful period in my life. And I'm so fortunate that I got to experience a dream that I had as a kid, you know, cause believe me, you know, there's not how many, you know, superstar sort of rock bands have sax players in it.
Yeah, that's right. But I, you know, in the '80s was all about saxophone and pop music. I mean, so that was kind of a thing. And I think that maybe acted as a springboard. So maybe you were still riding the wave of the saxophone revolution of the 1980s.
I guess, I don't know. I mean, you know, I was lucky. I mean, cause they had sax, but you know, then I put sax in certain things that didn't have sax and all that stuff. But yeah, in the British, you know, when the Britain explosion came around again through MTV, you know, they had the English beat and a lot of the bands that did use sax occasionally, but it wasn't in every song.
Right. Right.
But no, so it was, you know, a great time.
So are you still performing now? Do you still play?
No, I still play a little bit, but, you know, I won't get into this, but the reason I became a political blogger was because a doctor basically disabled me. So,
oh my God.
So, you know, that's what sort of turned my life into a different direction.
But did you have like a hand injury or something that required treatment, or was this an accident?
I was playing the House of Blues and I jumped up and I felt this pull in my midsection. And doctors thought it was nerve damage. I don't want to get into the whole history of
Sure, of course.
But it's like it basically has, you know, hampered me for a long time.
What a shame.
So it made me, I couldn't go back on the road.
Yeah. But do you still pick it up? Do you still play the instrument? Do you still pick it up
It still bugs me. You know, I have to be sort of careful, but when I'm in a good spot, then I can, you know, play again. I'm actually slowly starting to put a few things online.
Yeah.
But, you know, back when I was doing it, you know, when I was playing with all these different people, it wasn't, you know, video cameras everywhere.
It's amazing. There's quite an overlap between playing rock music, being a professional musician, and being a political blogger. Like, I know Charles Johnson from Little Green Footballs, and he was... Right. An extremely accomplished guitar player with all of these, you know,
absolutely
huge, huge names. Stanley Clarke, for example, Al Jarreau.
Oh, yeah.
And so you guys both have that in common, where you were once musicians touring with these A-listers, and now you're kind of A-lister bloggers. And I wonder if there's a connection there. I wonder if we all at heart want to be rock stars, John.
I don't know, you know. It's funny. I make you laugh. When I was 12, Liberace was like a big influence. So I wasn't a rock star. It was Liberace. With his fun with the piano. And,
hey, he was an amazing musician. Yeah, you know,
he was what he was, you know, and it's like, wow. You know, and I got a piano after that. So that was sort of the first time I got an instrument.
Oh, that's remarkable.
But
so what's next for Crooks and Liars? Do you have anything on the horizon as far as any new technology, any new direction you want to go with the site?
Well, you know, we're actually getting ready in August. We'll be releasing our new homepage, which is, we're just, you know, going through the codes and making things easier. And so we'll be releasing a new homepage and then hopefully, you know, moving on. I mean, I've been wanting to do a podcast for a long time, and every time I get ready to do it, you know, too much work happens, and then my injury, and I have to just, I can't do it. So, so we're looking at that, but right now we're focusing on our redesign. And so that'll be coming out probably in the second week of August.
Yeah. Well, I got to tell you, before we wrap up here, I got to thank you so much for allowing me to participate on some level with Crooks and Liars. There was a period of time there where I was contributing blog entries and so on to you guys, and it was such a treat. I mean, I started like all the rest of us, where I had my own little blog, and it was only because of attention from places like the Huffington Post and, of course, you guys at Crooks and Liars that I was able to continue to advance up the ladder. And so I'm immensely grateful for that. So thank you.
It's my pleasure. You know, one of the big features, like, there's this tremendous musician, Mike Finnegan, and he was a big influence. He was a great friend of mine, and he's the one who actually got me more involved with politics. So what we did early on is, you'll still see it on our website every day, is it's called Mike's Blog Roundup.
Yeah.
And so what we would do, and Mike was doing it for a while, was he would go for, like, you know, the less traffic writers that he liked, we would put links and just say, read these cool stories from liberal, you know, progressive bloggers or news stories. Mm-hmm. And so it was a way for me to give back, you know, to the community immediately, because the fact that I was, you know, that Crooks and Liars, you know, was being successful, I wanted to share the, you know, sort of the traffic as much as I could.
Yeah.
And so, we've been doing Mike's Blog Roundup, you know, since the inception of Crooks and Liars. Maybe it's like 16 years as opposed to 17.
God, it's been so long. Yeah.
And, you know, Mike was a big influence, and you should look up Mike Finnegan's discography. Just amazing person. But anyway,
so
we're just, you know, I mean, the fight is still on, you know, we're trying to get through this quagmire of conspiracy theory insanity. I think the country needs us more than ever.
Are you taking a little bit of a hit on traffic because people are kind of tuning out politics this year?
Well, right? From what I read, the whole internet is down.
Yeah.
And it has to also, also when you got people that have been locked up, you know, you know, because of a pandemic for over a year.
Yeah.
And the weather is getting nice. People just want to go out.
That's right. Yeah.
So, yes, you know, and hopefully, you know, the following year, we got the midterms coming.
Yeah.
Anybody wants to come to the site, you know, check it out.
And, yeah, absolutely. The legendary website is crooksandliars.com, one of the Pantheon blogs that you should be following every day. Make sure, if it's not bookmarked, I mean, I've had the Crooks and Liars bookmark in my internet browser for and going from computer to computer to computer. I mean, I've had 1,000 computers since Blogosphere 1.0, and that bookmark has always been in that folder, right? The same bookmark that I created in 2005 or whatever it was. Meanwhile, you can follow John on Twitter at John Amato, link in the description at bobsesca.com. Thank you so much, my friend, and thank you for your support in the early days. I really valued the opportunity to be a part of blogging history and your legendary website. So thank you again.
Yeah, I'm glad to have helped. You know, you're a great guy. I'm you know, all good tidings to your podcast and to your continued ventures, because, you know, we need all the good, credible, honest voices that we can have out there.
Well, thank you so much, my friend. I can't wait to have you on again. You're certainly welcome back anytime. Yeah, absolutely.
All right, buddy.
All right. Hey, thanks again, John. Take care, man.
Thanks, Bob.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.